It's Saturday, May 3rd, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in machine-to-machine and the Internet of Things platform. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the studio with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler. Hey, Ben.
How's it going? How are you doing?
Quite well. Thank you so much. Well, I was worried we didn't have enough news stories today, but that is not the case.
No, it's not.
So before we dive into some great news stories and probably take some calls at the end of the show, let's first do some corrections.
Yes, I've got a correction on behalf of the illustrious Miles Elam, who is not here to make the correction himself. In other words, Miles made a boo-boo and then ran away. the story that we covered last week, was about Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Russia and SpaceX. And SpaceX, the story was actually that SpaceX was suing the federal government to say, hey, why are you buying launch vehicles from Russia, and this contract is not open for commercial competition.
Okay.
And so that was really the issue. And actually, there's a follow-up story as well that was just 2 days ago on May 1st, saying that a U.S. Court of Federal Claims judge issued an injunction saying, you know what, they're right. Yeah.
Really?
This should be publicly.
Now, SpaceX, of course, is a commercial company mm-hmm. trying to do space flight and have been winning prize in some early expeditions into space travel.
Yeah, they have been kicking butt.
Yeah, that's another way to say it. Yeah. And so it looks like the courts are saying, yeah, it's true that the federal government should potentially be looking at opening contracts up for space travel.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Especially because we don't really have, the United States at least, doesn't really have launch vehicles anymore. I mean, NASA isn't producing these anymore because there just isn't budget for that. And that's why companies like SpaceX exist, or at least one big reason why they exist.
Yeah.
And I think that they should have all the opportunities as other nations do.
All right. Space is cool. So that was actually technically Miles' story. He's just not here to cover the correction. So thank you for doing that for you. For him.
He's such a pedant, too.
No, not at all.
He's always correcting me.
Oh, is that how it is?
Yeah, and then he runs away when he makes a mistake.
So. You keep on saying runs away. You're like, you're trying to get
run
his
away,
ire.
Run
Any
away.
Case,
I'm just trying to get him to come to the station today and be like, okay, I'll defend myself.
Okay, but you've come to the station. You've got some space stories as
I
well.
Do. I've got a great one, which is we have a planet that we discovered quite a while ago. And it is called Beta Pic B, which is, I think, kind of a strange name for planets. I think astronomers should be a little bit more interesting with their naming conventions.
There are a lot of them.
But there are a lot of names that you could,
So what's special about this exoplanet Beta?
Yes, so Beta Pic B. Yeah, it's very memorable, isn't it?
Thanks.
So yeah, it's an exoplanet, first of all. So it's not within our solar system. It's not within...
It orbits a different star.
It orbits a different star. It doesn't orbit our star, Sol. It's a massive gas giant, so it's kind of like Jupiter. It's actually a little bit larger. It's in a system about 63 light years away, and we discovered it back in 2003, and we confirmed its existence in 2009. So we've known about it for a while, but one of the cool things about it is it's close enough that we can directly image it.
Oh, cool.
And so we can point our telescope at it and we can see all kinds of interesting things about it. So the story, actually, I'll put up on geekspeak.org, and you can see not only a picture of the planet. Now, this is like fuzzy dot, right? Fuzzy dot. But you can also see a visible light spectrum of the sun, which will make a little bit more sense when I talk about the big discovery with this is that we actually figured out how fast this thing is spinning.
Interesting.
And
how?
How? Yeah, how is it?
So the way we detect exoplanets normally is their gravitational lensing effect or their wobble effect of their star.
Not gravitational lensing, but the occlusion.
The occlusion.
The occlusion of the star.
Light occlusion.
Basically, you've got a star, you've got a planet, and the planet passes in front of the star.
And it dims.
And we're so far away, we can't see the planet and the star optically independently from each other. And so instead, we just see this dot of light. That's the star.
Yeah.
If the star's light output seems to diminish for a second and then come back up, and then maybe a year later it diminishes and then comes back up in a pattern, we can infer that there's something going around it which might be passing in front of it.
And that's the other thing we see is we can see a wobble effect of the star moving back and forth from us and causing its light to shift, like a Doppler shift.
Yes.
Okay, so, but we also able to visualize this one directly, and we're tell us about the light that.
Well, actually, the way that we were able to figure it out is that second method. So first, I'll just really quickly explain that second method. It's based on the star's wobble. So as the planet goes around the star, if you imagine, let's say, ice skaters, right? We tend to think of the planet going around the star, but the reality is they're going around each other.
Right.
Just like if you have a very heavy ice skater and a very lightweight ice skater and they're spinning, the heavier ice skater isn't rotating as much, isn't moving as much.
But they do rotate around.
Yeah, they're rotating around each other. And so what we can do is the other method is as the planet rotates around the star rotates around the planet and kind of shifts in space a little bit forwards and away from us, forwards and away.
And if you've ever sat on a freeway and you have cars coming towards you and then they go away from you, you hear them go, and they go higher pitch to lower pitch, and that's called the Doppler effect, the compression and pulling apart of the sound waves. Light does the same thing, and
same
it shifts
thing.
The light in the color spectrum.
Exactly. So we see the light shift a little bit more towards the red and then a little bit more towards the blue and then a little more towards
the red. And that's one of the detection mechanisms. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how do we know that the Jovian size planet is actually rotating?
Well, Jovian size. Good word. So check this out. If you imagine a spinning ball, and this ball is the Earth, let's say, or this ball is a planet. If you're just looking at the ball and it's spinning, one side of the ball is coming toward you.
Yes.
And one side is going away.
And if light's reflecting off both of them, you get a difference? No.
No. It's that if you get light from the planet and you can observe the light from the planet and you can figure out, this particular frequency indicates that there is CO2 in the atmosphere.
Okay.
This particular frequency indicates that there's this other thing in the atmosphere,
sure.
Right? That's called a spectrograph. Basically, you take the light and you pull it apart into the red to blue spectrum, the visible
light
spectrum.
Like with a prism in science class.
Yeah, and actually you can go beyond visible light spectrum, but we tend to think of it just as visible light. And if you have one side that's coming towards you, one side that's going away, the stuff that's coming towards you is going to be blue shifted,
right?
And the stuff that's going away is going to be red shifted. So instead of sharp lines, they actually saw these fuzzy lines because part of it is going towards you. The one side of the ball is going towards you. The other side is going away. And then the stuff that's on the part of the ball that's closest to you isn't really going away from you or towards
you. So instead of really clean prismatic lines representing the elements of the spectrographic signature of the material that's the light that's being affected, you saw a slight blurring. And because of the depth, the width of that blurring and the size, potential size of the planet, they were able to figure out how fast it's spinning. How fast is it spinning? Is it spinning faster than our Jupiter or Saturn?
It is spinning really, really fast.
And it's so, probably why we're able to detect it, because it's spinning so fast. It helps with the detection.
That helps.
Very cool.
And you want to know how fast. We can determine the length of the day. The length of this larger than Jupiter size planet, the length of the day is 8 hours approximately.
So it's spinning
really
fast.
It's spinning three times faster than Earth, and it's way bigger.
Beta Pic B is spinning fast.
Yeah, it's such a great story. There's actually even more information.
And some pictures.
Yeah, and some pictures. Oh, and one other thing, which I think is pretty cool. It's shaped a little bit more like a squished sphere.
Yeah,
because
it's spinning so fast. Sure.
Yeah, the equator is coming out.
And it's
and
a gas giant, so there's not like a lot of ground. It's kind of just...
And it's
puffy.
Actually hot, and so as it gets cooler over its lifetime, it's actually going to get even smaller, and it's going to spin faster. So anyway, up on their website, we'll have that's actually at the Bad Astronomy blog as well, so we'll put a link to it.
And you can learn about what we're talking about at geekspeak.org. Okay, so speaking of online sources, I have spoken before about the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and actually we've had people on.
Frontier Freedom Foundation. Freedom Frontier.
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
You got it. Okay.
I did it right this time, and you corrected me. Darn it. It's just years of mistakes. Anyway, we've had
we'll
people
issue
on.
A correction.
We've had people on from the foundation before. This organization is dedicated to supporting individual rights, freedoms, in the digital age. Now, Mozilla recently released a large report showing, and Mozilla is making their Firefox, that the biggest concern for people in their browsing experience is privacy. That's the thing they seem to want the most of. And it seems to make sense that it's kind of a complicated issue. We have a lot of concerns around it, and it's so complicated that there's a little bit of, and there's ire around this idea of privacy. So Mozilla showed this report. Now, what's happening, we've covered the story Do Not Track, which is a flag that you can be sent around. The general concern around privacy right now is these large advertising companies are making money from us visiting sites. The more they know about us, the more potential revenue they can get. And so if you're a company having a website and you have an advertiser on it, and there's another site also has an advertiser on it, it's possible for that advertiser to actually track your movements around the website, around the web.
Yeah, especially if they're a big ad network or something like
that. So it's very difficult to actually fight this, and technically it's kind of an interesting problem we've talked about for years.
And also it monetizes a lot of the web.
Yes.
So if advertising all does go away, then
So there's this big debate about how much you have to track people to actually successfully advertise to them. And of course, a company that's interested in having a leg up is going to push that boundary really far. Now, there's a movement to actually support this flag called the Do Not Track flag. And basically, to have your browser says that the user has chosen to turn the flag on. That's a very important part of Do Not Track, meaning that the person actually cares. And they turn on this flag, and then the website is supposed to respect that flag and not track you. Now, we've known for a while that some of these companies are just completely ignoring the Do Not Track request. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation has released an alpha project, not a beta pick B project, but an alpha project. This means that it's a pre-release of a plugin for your browser, either Mozilla, Firefox.
I like to think
Firefox.
Of it as a pre-release.
Yeah, except that they're already using it internally, so I don't know why they're calling it alpha. I kind of think it was a beta program. But any case, what you can do is if you're using Firefox or Chrome, you can go to the EFF's site, download a plugin for your browser, and this is called Badger, which is a great name for a plugin.
Badger.
And what Badger does is it looks at the advertising content that goes to your page. It tries to create a large list of good advertisers that are not tracking you and respecting your Do Not Track code, and advertisers that aren't. And then it blocks the ones that aren't respecting the tracking code. So basically,
oh, I like that idea.
Yeah, it basically adds another level of protection for you, but in such a way, their aims are to make advertisers respect and have strong policies around Do Not Track. That's their aim. So basically,
this is actually interesting because a lot of people have been seeing Do Not Track, which has been something we've been following for the last year, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
A lot of people have seen it as a failure because there are so many companies that don't pay attention
don't respect
to it.
It.
And so actually, one of the news stories that I had just that fits in here is that as of a couple of days ago, Yahoo said that the Do Not Track settings won't be enabled on Yahoo anymore.
So they'll ignore the setting.
They're basically saying, yeah, Do Not Track. I mean, now Yahoo was one of the first companies to implement this. So they're awesome in that way. Basically, this is them saying, you know what? It didn't really work very well, and we're going to give up on it.
The issue is if there's four advertisers and three of them are ignoring the Do Not Track, they're going to get more data. They're going to be able to advertise better, and it's going to be more viable. So the company that's respecting the Do Not Track is actually at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
And that's a tricky place to be in the commercial industry.
And vice versa. If you have 5 or 10 advertisers and one of them is respecting Do Not Track, they're at a significant disadvantage.
Yeah.
So where's the incentive, right?
Yeah.
It's the other.
So this project Badger, the point of it is let's figure out which companies are respecting Do Not Track and which ones are not, and stop serving the ads, the ones that aren't.
So provide a disincentive.
That's right. And if a company is blocked from their service, if they change their commitment to Do Not Track, if they make a strong commitment to Do Not Track, they'll get removed from the blockage. So basically, it's forcing advertising companies to support Do Not Track. So I urge you to try, if you're interested in this privacy issue online, to go ahead and try to, and you use Chrome or Firefox, go ahead and get this plugin. It's called Badger. And of course, you can learn more about this at geekspeak.org in just a little bit. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is KUSP. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. When Asha DeVoe was growing up in Sri Lanka, marine biologists there were scarce. especially female ones. So she made her own way. She got her PhD and began researching the waters around Sri Lanka, often on her own, with little funding, equipment, or resources. Now she's a leading expert on an unusual group of Sri Lankan blue whales and an ocean activist with a worldwide reputation. She talks with KOSP's Robert Polly about her career studying Earth's greatest, largest creature. That's tomorrow on the 7th Avenue Project here on KOSP. You are listening to KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. And with me in the air room is geek Ben Jaffe. Now, why is Ben a geek? There's a lot of reasons. Ask him about Star Trek trivia. He'll get it. If you want to talk about different types of scales in music, you can have a long conversation with him. Anything that you might be excited in, if you share it with Ben, you'll probably find excitement as well. That's what makes him a geek. But one of the core things that makes him a computer geek is his ability to navigate his computer quickly and efficiently without using a mouse or trackpad. Now,
aw, shucks, Lyle.
You're actually so good at this that you have an old Twitter handle that you used for a while that was shortcuts. Now,
what
we're talking about is when you spend a lot of time on a computer, the more efficient you can do things on a keyboard and moving around your environment, the better and faster you are at doing things. So,
yeah, that's definitely true.
If you have to switch to a mouse, you can actually cause a lot more wrist damage because over time, mice actually do a lot of large movements. Keyboards are actually potentially easier for your hands to deal with.
Potentially, and it all depends on your specific setup. And actually, I had to Google my own Twitter account because I haven't posted
it
for a while. It's called Command Tab. So if you follow Command Tab.
Put what you use for your window manager. Now, a window manager.
I want to talk about that.
What's a window manager?
What is a window manager? Well, so on your computer, you've got Windows, and oftentimes you have far too many of them.
Now,
so
we don't mean a Windows computer. It could be a Macintosh as well, but the actual drawing frame that actually holds an application is called a window.
Uh-huh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so So a couple things. First of all, sometimes I'll see people like, oh, I want to get to that window, but I know it's behind all these other windows, so I'll just drag all these windows out of the way to get to it, right? So that's a perfectly reasonable way of doing it, especially coming from the real world. But
it's like hunting.
There are
or fishing.
Hunting.
It's like fishing, right? You have like move things out of the way.
Well, if you have a bunch of papers all over your desk, you move the papers all out of each other's way to get to the one that's at the bottom. But there are all these tools on the computer to help you with that. Well, one of the tools that I use is called Moom, and it's a window manager, meaning it will let you use either keyboard shortcuts or your mouse to automatically move windows. Like, let's say I want to move this particular window all the way to the right side of the screen, and then move another one all the way to the left side of the screen. I can set up keyboard shortcuts for that. It's a really, really fantastic application. It's from a company that I really love called ManyTricks.com. Most of their apps are paid, but I just think they're definitely geeks. They're the kinds of people who I would want to be friends with.
One of the things that's great about this, you actually have good commands like this. One of the things you can do is take the current window and take up half the screen to the left or right, mm-hmm. and then you can select another window and take half the screen to the other side. And you basically get two windows aligned perfectly together. I use that command feature a lot. I actually, for a long time, have been using an application called Spectacle on a OS X, mm-hmm. or Specs. Let's see, let me look it up real quick. It's Spectacle, and it allows me to do the same thing, different types of commands. All of these are kind of configurable what commands you can use. But when we're doing the radio show, for example, I've got the script that has all the readings that I have to do, and I also have the news stories, and they're both pushed to the side so I can see them both at the same time, which is pretty cool.
And these are the kinds of conversations that you and I tend to have all the time.
In fact, last week when I saw you, I said, oh, wait, you're using Moom? No, you've got to use Slate, because Slate is fantastic. Now, Slate is the programmer's window manager.
What do you mean by that?
All right. So the way these window managers normally work is there's an interface you can assign command keys to maybe 15 different things they can do. Push to the left, push to the right.
So there's a user interface.
Yeah, a very
That's
clear
how
user
you
interface.
Create
That's how
your
you actually work on it. Right. Slate is not like that. Slate is a JSON file that actually, it's a JavaScript file that you can actually program your Windows environment. Now, both of us are JavaScript programmers, right?
Yeah, I was thinking.
So what you can do is you can say, instead of say half the width, you can say one third the width. Or if this window is Chrome, do this. If it's,
Adium or something,
do this with it.
Client.
You can configure a whole bunch of it. You basically, it's a programming environment for your window management. So if you want to be supreme geek, you use Slate.
Now, I just have to say, About a year or two ago, I came into your office and I was like, hey, Lyle, you got to check out this da-da-da-da, and I showed it to you and you were really impressed and you tried it out and you liked it. And last week, you came to me and you said, oh, you're using this, try this instead. And I did. And Slate is phenomenal, right? So I was talking about how great Moom is.
How much time you spent programming shortcuts for moving things around? I mean, can you waste more time in a week to decrease the functionality of the entire year that you'll be using it? That's the question. Because when you start programming your own window environment, there's no end to it. You can do anything you want. Right?
So I had a very, very, very busy week. So I only spent about 2 hours on it.
2 hours to potentially over the next week save 30 seconds.
Well, yeah, but over the next 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. What's that? That's
no, but I think
30 seconds.
I think you actually save a lot more.
Yeah.
And also, it doesn't feel good to move windows around.
Also, that's exactly the point. Like, it's not so much a one-to-one. It's not now I have to move this window over here, and it takes me 12 seconds longer. It's more, oh, I don't feel like moving that window over there, so I'm just going to keep tabbing back and forth between them for the next 2 hours.
We'll link to Slate and Moom and Spectacle on GeekSpeak show page once Ben and I get off
absolutely
air and have a chance to finish that page.
And if you just want a summary, basically Slate is great if you like programming and if you really like getting into the guts with that. Moom is great if you either want a really simple solution or if you want to get a complicated solution, but you also don't want to program.
And is Slate and Moom is paid, right?
Slate is free. Moom is like $10 or something around that.
All right, cool. So that's window managers. Geeks use them a lot, and they're fun. And as long as you remember your key commands to use them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's about making your computer home.
You know, next time on Geek Speak, we should talk about our launching tools for text launching.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So. One of the stories we've covered quite a bit in the beginning of this year has been Heartbleed, and that's the security craziness around the OpenSSL project.
Yeah.
We heard a lot about it. There's been a lot of concerns. And basically, one of the things that keeps on talking about is this project called OpenSSL, which had the vulnerability that caused a lot of problems. Now, OpenSSL is an open source project developing, I think like 3 or 4 people develop it. And what's interesting...
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
How many people use products that use products that use that?
Steve McCarr from the Open Source Software Foundation president, he's the president, says, it takes nerves of steel to work on many years on hundreds of thousands of lines of very complex code, knowing that you'll be ignored and unappreciated until something goes wrong.
Oh.
And that is the truth. No one cared about OpenSSL except for us geeks and using it, and we loved it, until this massive security vulnerability emerges that affects 1/3 of the internet traffic and tons of man hours and lots of fear all around a simple mistake in a line of code. Keep in mind, the person that wrote that code did not get paid by anybody. Mm-hmm. They did it for the love of programming and the love of solving a problem, which is beautiful, but maybe not the best way to make robust software.
Yeah.
And I definitely feel that open source software is a crucial, especially in security. Yeah. That's a kind of almost an idiom of mine. But when it comes down to how do you create open source software and keep it going, strong? Normally, the projects that do really, really well have some kind of backer.
So, is there any kind of plan to make that happen?
Because okay. So here's another quote I want to read off.
Yeah.
Ibn Muglan, a Colombian law school professor and founding director of the Software Freedom Law Center. Says dedicated programmers to continue dedicated programmers to continue maintaining and improving the free and open source software that makes the net work safely for us all. This is a business and community celebration in the public interest. And what he's talking about is this project called the Core Infrastructure Initiative. Now, Linux operating system is an open source project, and some pieces of Linux operating system or the core foundational pieces is a group of software that every Linux distribution has. OpenSSL is one of them, for example. Mm-hmm. And so this initiative is going to pulled in $3.9 million in seed money from Amazon, Cisco, Dell, Facebook, Fujitsu, Google, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, NetApp, Rackspace, and VMware, and more people are joining up all the time, basically to say, here's a whole bunch of money, let's pay for the developers to work on these projects. And it hopefully will add incentive for more eyes to get onto to these open source projects and better code to come out of them.
You know, I love that idea, so long as the money isn't saying do it this way or do it that way.
Right.
You know. So that's I think really the crux of it. Like, it's okay for money to go to open source projects.
But
it's
you wouldn't want the federal government to be paying for all the security infrastructure, right?
Well, I'm okay if they're paying for it.
But if they're influencing it.
Not if they're influencing the direction it takes.
So the Linux Foundation chief marketing officer, Amanda McPherson, kind of addressed that and said that for choosing the projects that will actually be supported, how it will work will be determined, so she says, determined by the steering committee and advisory board. The final call will be made by the core infrastructure initiative steering committee, which will be informed by key developers and industry stakeholders and experts who will sit on the advisory board.
So oversight.
Oversight. Lots of oversight.
Good, yeah.
Lots of transparency. That's the thing is, you know, I sit on the W3C committee on web apps, mm-hmm. and this is a protocol about the web infrastructure, HTML5 web app code bases. It's all the standards we talk about all the time in web application development. And in that committee, I'm, you know, one of the representatives, everything's transparent. Everybody gets to talk about all of it. And over a long period of time, conclusions are brought up that have been thoroughly vetted by experts. And that is a really lovely way to figure out technical solutions, I have to say.
Yeah.
So McPherson said, and this is Amanda McPherson, the Linux Foundation's chief marketing officer, that most of these projects are well known to computing experts who will be on the steering committee and advisory board. So applications aren't needed, but there will be a way for projects to request funding on the site. So right now, there's so much need for funding projects that we already know so well and are so dear to us, like OpenSSL.
Yeah.
There's projects like that. We already know we need to fund those. So in the initial state, it's just about how much the money gets divvied up. Now, of course, more companies are throwing money in, and this initiative is going to be, I think, highly successful. So I'm really excited.
So why are companies throwing money in? I mean, they all have a vested interest, I'm thinking.
They're all using it. Exactly.
They all have incentive for making it.
What just happened with the vulnerability in OpenSSL, the Heartbleed thing, was expensive for these companies.
Yeah.
Really expensive.
Yeah.
And if this bug had been found and fixed years ago, it would have been less of an expense. So it's almost an insurance policy. A lot of companies rely on open source software.
Yeah.
And we saw another example of this in the last, I think, the 19th of April's episode of Geek Speak. Miles brought up a story about TrueCrypt and auditing TrueCrypt.
Yeah.
TrueCrypt is an open source project that's about hard drive encryption and making private your data on your hard drive. And what was realized is it's such a complicated application that maybe it'd be a good idea for some software engineers to come and look at it and really tear it apart.
And make sure that there aren't any actual issues, either backdoors or security vulnerabilities
exactly.
or any of those kinds of things.
And Miles' story is, of course, talking about how so far it's looking really good. To do that audit, though, costs money.
Yes.
And that's the kind of thing that money around open source projects can help with. Pay for developers, but also auditing, and be more clear about what the open source software is doing. So that's the Core Infrastructure Initiative. I'm so glad that that's happening now.
Cool. So I like it. I really, really like it.
Let's get simpler, okay? Let's talk about pyramids.
Sure. Well, we all know that the pyramids were built by aliens
yes.
from outer space.
Yes, absolutely.
And
scientific fact.
Actually, I guess my story doesn't really mean anything anymore, so we'll move on.
No, let's assume for a second that the pyramids in Giza were not made by extraterrestrials, but instead by, I don't know, humans. How might they have moved things?
A lot of humans, yeah. So this is an interesting story. Some physicists from the FOM Foundation and the University of Amsterdam were pondering this question, and they discovered that the friction, or rather the force needed to move a heavy thing over sand, which is what they were basically doing for statues and the bricks and blocks for the pyramids, that you can actually decrease the amount of force that is necessary to pull things over sand. And it's actually really simple to do. So normally what would happen is you put some kind of weight on a sledge or something like that, basically a sled, right? And then you get a whole bunch of people in the front and you pull. And what happens is a whole bunch of sand kind of gathers up in the front of the sledge.
And you're pulling
and
up here.
You're pulling not only the sand all kind of along with the sledge, but you're also kind of pulling uphill. So that's no good.
So that's kind of a description of how the friction of sand, pulling on sand actually is working.
Yeah, yeah, although it seems to be a slightly more complicated issue than just simple kinetic friction. But yeah, so how do you deal with that? So it turns out if you just moisten the sand a little bit, then you don't get that
bulge.
The bulge, yeah.
You don't get the fluid effect of the pile of sand. Yeah,
yeah.
The front wave. It's kind of like a front wave, right?
Yeah, so this is actually the new theory.
You just wet it?
You just put a little water on it.
So it wasn't space travel, it was just water? It wasn't aliens, it's just water?
Exactly.
Cool.
So the required pulling force decreases proportional to the stiffness of the sand. Now, of course, you can't just put a whole bunch of water in the sand because
then you hit it too loose.
It gets really kind of squishy and weird. So, but if you can get it just right, you can actually half the amount of force.
I can imagine the engineers in front with like little bladders with water in them squirting and, you know, testing the sand with their fingers.
Right.
We're ready now. And pulls along. Very cool.
I like that image that you have in your head. Now, here's actually the question I have, though, is if you have to transport these things really, really far, that means you also have to transport water to wet the sand. So it's kind of an interesting equation. I don't actually think this story talks about it, but it's just kind of an interesting thing I was thinking about. Like, when you're launching a spaceship into space, you're not launching just the astronauts and the vehicle itself. You're also launching the fuel that is required in the latter parts of the journey, right? So your spaceship is actually very, very heavy at the beginning because you're carrying the fuel that you need at the very, very end. So it's kind of this crazy formula that says, if you want to launch something a little bit heavier into space, you actually need a lot more fuel and a lot more power. It kind of seems like a similar thing here. So the further you have to pull the statue or the block for the pyramid, the more water you need.
But awesome.
Anyway, I don't know. Having your amount of workers by just moistening some sand, that's kind of cool.
Not bad at all. So SanDisk is a manufacturer of hard drive technology.
Did you say SanDisk?
SanDisk. I kind of picked this story after your sand story, so that was kind of funny. It's SanDisk. But yes, it's SanDisk.
SanDisk.
Non-wet sand. SanDisk released a 4 terabyte enterprise class solid state drive.
4 terabytes?
4 terabytes. That's a big drive.
What?
4 terabyte solid state drive.
Yeah. Not the ones that spin.
So hard drives traditionally were spinning platters, magnetic spinning platters, and they just eventually just bad things happen. Hard drives fail. Back up your data, please. So the solid state drives, the new technology that's basically non-spinning material, they've been more expensive and they've been a lot less density, a lot less data storage on these devices. But SanDisk has a 4 terabyte drive, which is right up there with the spinners. And it's enterprise class level, which means you can put it in data centers. And also, it also means that it's not using kind of this tricky way of making disks a lot cheaper. But we won't get into that solid state drives. And they also have like 2 other disks, a 1.6 terabyte, which has a lot faster speed throughput. But basically, what we're seeing is the move away from spinning disks, spinning platters, to solid state drives, which is freaking fantastic because they last a lot longer. They use less energy. They're lighter. They're shock
absorbent, they don't get affected by shock as much,
right? And now when I have my laptop in my car in my backpack, I don't necessarily put it on the floor. I sometimes put it on the seat because I once had a crash and like a car accident, and my hard drive was my disk. My laptop was sitting in the chair, and it flew into the footwell, and I didn't know it, but my data was bad from that point on. And my drive was slowly degrading. It was really bad news. Only time I've ever actually lost data was because of that. In any case,
wow.
New tech is pretty awesome.
I just have to say, I hate this because I just got a new computer. Oh. I have a terabyte hard drive inside. And I'm like, oh, I have a terabyte solid state drive inside. I'm so cool. And then you come out with this story.
Dude, you're still cool.
brings technological progress.
This is Geek Speak. You are listening to KSP and KSP.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. We are actually online at geekspeak.org. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. We're now going to open up the phone lines. In the other room is Rick, and he'll be happy to plug you into the air room and be on air to ask us questions about technology or add information about the stories we've covered. So please feel free to call us with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. We were just talking about hard drives, Ben. The other older technology of hard drives is?
Yeah, I mean, it's tape drives, actually, tape storage. We were talking about how solid-state drives might bring the obsolescence of the spinning hard drives. But I actually wasn't planning on covering this story, but the quick explanation is that Sony actually just announced a breakthrough in magnetic tape technology. Now, for a while, we used to back up.
I'm sorry, that's just funny. SanDisk 4 terabyte solid state. So it was like, oh yeah?
Yeah. 1995 called and they want their tape breakthroughs back.
The truth is actually tape storage is really inexpensive and massive.
Like, yeah,
you can store a lot on tape.
A lot of data on tape and really, really reliable.
And shelf life.
And has a long shelf life. Yeah, you can have it sitting for years and years and years. And then when you plug it in, you're not really as worried about, oh, when is this?
Every time
spin?
You bring it back, it's the 80s.
Because
it's tape. Okay, go on.
That's true.
So what's the new breakthrough on Sony's tape technology?
Now, they don't have this in actual technology that they're selling
production,
yet, right?
Okay.
But it's a technological breakthrough that they're saying increases the data density per square inch for tapes by a factor of 74.
That's big.
74.
So you used to think tapes were big. Now it's really big.
Now they're 75 or 4 times bigger. They could be. So the result could be, they're saying, 185 terabyte tape cartridges.
Sweet.
So that's almost 50 times bigger than your stupid 4 terabyte SSD.
And is the enclosure an 8-track cassette?
You know, I have no clue. I mean, I'm just reading the summary because I wasn't planning on covering this story. But it just seemed too timely. I mean, We're hanging out just dissing hard drives that we're still using, and I've got a story saying, tapes might be coming back.
You don't have a spinning hard drive in your computer, do you?
No, I don't. Not anymore.
So we're not using them.
My last computer, which died only because the Wi-Fi stopped working, I actually had two hard drives in that. It's a MacBook Pro, and I took out the
CD
optical drive because everyone's
geek.
Yeah.
So...
And it was just awesome, I just have to say, because I had 120 gigabytes of solid state, and that was my boot drive, and then I had 500 gigabytes of extra storage, and that was my spinny drive.
We are talking about storage media here on Geeks for Today. Actually, you can call us with any questions you have about technology. We can answer anything.
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 We can try.
Well, we can definitely answer
it. We can't answer it.
Might not be accurate.
Necessarily.
We can answer it. The phone number to call in with questions and comments about technology, curious about something in your machine, have an idea about a new future tech, please feel free to call us. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Did you ever see the movie A Beautiful Mind?
You know what?
That's
one of the very few. One of the very few that I did see, and the score, beautiful score, was by James Horner.
Yeah, that's a good movie, and it actually, it's Russell Crowe stars in it, and he is playing the scientist John Forbes Nash,
yeah.
Junior, actually,
Junior,
and he was a game theory pioneer, and also got a Nobel Prize, I think, in economics for some of his concepts, and amazing scientist, a little bit. Different in the way he thought, and that's what that film kind of explores. It's called A Beautiful Mind because it's kind of beautiful.
It's more about his mind than about the ideas.
Well, one of his equations or something is called the Nash Equilibrium, named after his last name. The Nash Equilibrium, you might have heard it. It actually is around a game that you can play, which you probably have played, and that game involves your hands and winning. And basically, it's rock, paper, scissors. So, I hope everyone knows what rock, paper, scissors is. You can make these three shapes of your hand. Rock, a paper, which is your hand open. A rock is your hand closed tight. And scissors is the peace symbol. Two fingers.
But sideways.
And with rock, paper, scissors, you basically, beforehand, you'll do a count. Ben and I will play real quick.
Wait, I love that we're explaining rock, paper, scissors on the air.
It's important.
All right. Rock, paper, scissors. So
okay, we both got rocks. That was kind of boring. So what's interesting is there was a – I love this – a massive rock, paper, scissors tournament in Zhejiang University in China. I think that's beautiful. Like right there, a massive rock, paper, scissors tournament.
I love it.
Now, Nash's theorem is basically that it's going to be one third. It'll always be one third, right? You got three choices, you'll choose one third. And that's true. If you take a look at the scientists from MIT, took a look at the entire, all of the logs of exactly how the game was played by hundreds of people. And they looked at the statistics and yeah, sure enough, rock, paper, scissors is average. For all the good players, it's one third rock, paper, and scissors.
Are these rock, paper, scissors experts?
They are. They're champions. Why are you looking at me like that?
How many tournaments have there been?
And there's thousands of them. I have no idea, but we'll all go. We need to get funding to support Ben at Rock, Paper, Scissors Travel in China.
Right.
So in any case, that's true. That is one third.
Okay.
But what's interesting about the study is that actually the patterns are slightly predictable.
Wait, so it's not random?
No.
How is it not random if they're both thirds? it's our all thirds.
So because the distribution fluctuates from densities between different choices. And here's the basic idea. If you and I were to play and you were to win and I were to lose, it is more likely that you will use your winning thing you just did again, and I will change. It is more likely that I will change mine. So the percentages slightly shift based off of your winning and losing pattern. If you know this, you can take advantage and you can actually win more than your competitor who doesn't know this.
Unless your competitor knows that you know this.
Yes. And then it gets more level. So you thought rock, paper, scissors was a simple game, but you're wrong. It's really complex because you psychologically test the person. So you need to play many times with the person to actually get good at it because you have to get their pattern down. But you can predict and you can actually play the game in a strategic way. It's not just random.
Really?
Pretty cool, huh? Rock, paper, scissors, predictable. Start training now for Olympics.
You know,
2030.
If this were a video podcast or something, I'd be kind of interested in doing this in the background. But it's very boring on the radio to play rock, paper, scissors.
It's the perfect game for the radio. Let's play it again. You know what? Instead of doing that, let's go ahead and talk about some science.
Okay, science. So the only class
Let me remind people before you go into science story. You can call in with questions and comments about technology. We'll keep doing news, but please feel free to call in and we'll chat with you. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. That phone number is actually toll-free in the United States and Canada. Isn't that cool?
That's cool.
1-800-655-5877. Science, Ben?
Science. Now, this is the science that I'm slightly uncomfortable with because the only class I ever got a C in was chemistry.
Wait, the only class anywhere?
Okay. Do I really have to go into this?
No, you don't. Okay, go
on. I got a C in handwriting in first grade, and I was devastated because I really was trying my best. And that's what I was told, is if you try your best, it'll be okay. But anyway. But so I'm not...
Millennial. Okay, go on.
So yeah, chemistry isn't my strong suit. But I found this to be a very interesting story, which is that we actually found element 117 of the periodic table. Now...
It doesn't... Okay, go on.
It doesn't.
Okay, 117. Go on.
117. Now, those of you who are chemistry buffs might say, wait a second, didn't we already discover this? And yes, indeed, we first announced its discovery in 2010. But we very recently, just actually this month, last month rather, have been experiments that have confirmed it. So
yeah, cool.
Indeed, it does exist. And it is, yeah, go ahead.
What's it called? Element 117.
Element 117 could be one name. Another name is astatine or something like
okay.
that. Or you could also call it ununseptium. Ununseptium.
Ununseptium?
Because its current temporary symbol is UUS.
Oh, okay.
And actually, my favorite element of all time is unanunium, which I don't think is called unanunium anymore. Its symbol is UUU. And that's the only reason why I like it. There's nothing else that I know that's special about it. But anyway, so I read the story and I was thinking, like, what's the point? Why are we creating these elements? Because we're creating them.
Keep in mind, this element doesn't last very long, right?
Yeah, it's a fraction of a second, and then poof, it's gone. And it requires
is that why it's called un-un? Because it's barely there? Oh, it's gone.
Well, un-un would be a double negative, so would actually be there.
But it is there. It's just not very long.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes a lot of effort to make. So I don't know. But
why do we do this?
Why do we do this, Lyle?
I think the best way to say this is that science explores the universe and tries to make sense of it and come to comes to a conclusion that all of us can agree upon because we can all try it and test it ourselves.
And that's
assuming we have giant labs. But basically, that's the principle behind science.
And that's what engineering and other things are based on, right?
That's right. So engineering, to actually make things, you have to have rules that make sense and are studied. So engineering relies on science, and science explores craziness. And without that, you can't build things. But you can't predict what you're going to figure out and what you might build because it's a different step. So raw science produces wonder, and growth and knowledge, and engineering takes advantage of that thing and makes things cool.
Yeah, so like the question, how is going to space going to help us when we have so many problems on Earth? Well,
that's tricky. I'm not sure if it does make sense for us to go to space. I'm always out on that. I think it's important as a species
to
explore.
But
I think that we have so many other problems that it's really hard to justify. So, you know, emotionally, it's hard for me to justify space travel.
But what are you justifying? Are you justifying
the shift of expenses versus of resources? Like, we take these resources, we put them into space travel, which takes that we learn a whole bunch of, our knowledge base is growing, but we already know that people starve and we're not dealing with that.
That's
and
true.
And there's diseases that we should address. Like, so it's so hard for me to say, yes, space, 100%.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree with that. At the same time, when you look at where the money goes, if you take NASA's entire operating budget over the entire time that it existed, that includes the space shuttle, Apollo missions, everything, it all comes down to less than one funding cycle for the U.S. military.
Right.
So, context, right?
Right.
And we actually have gotten a lot of fantastic scientific discoveries from our explorations in space and all that stuff. So, I don't know. It's an open question, definitely.
I agree. You know, you can call in with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And when you do, you'll have something very much in common with Robert from Santa Cruz. Welcome to GeekSpeak, Robert.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yes. Hi.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Certainly. What's up?
So I have a question, and it's regarding my Google Plus account or my Gmail account. So I'm not certain if you can answer that, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. So here it is. Before Google Plus and Hangout and all that was created, I had a YouTube account, and you know, I would download or upload some of my videos to my YouTube account, and then all of a sudden I created, you know, a Gmail, soon thereafter a Gmail account and a Google Plus account, and then all of a sudden I noticed that I have two different profiles, and I'm not certain exactly when I did that, how I did that, or how it happened. And so some of my stuff is on one of my profiles, and then some of my videos are on the other. And
yeah.
I'm like, how the hell is that happening?
Yeah,
that's tough. So when
Google's notoriously bad at solving this problem.
Well, I don't know if they're notoriously bad.
In my circles, they are.
Yeah, okay. All right, fair enough then.
For me, myself, and I, they're notoriously bad.
It's a really tough problem to fix, definitely. I actually didn't have this problem. I'm not convinced that everyone could have avoided this, right?
Okay, so...
But for me, when Google Plus was announced, somehow, and maybe I clicked something, or maybe something popped up and I clicked the correct answer instead of the wrong one or something, but... somehow my Google Plus account and my YouTube account ended up being the same.
Right.
So
you got lucky.
I got lucky. Exactly. And so.
So actually, at one point when they were making this announcement about this merger and, uh-huh. and such, not an announcement, but it was happening, you actually could do a merge. And I think I had actually done it as well. Not really a merge, but a definition of which account was which by signing into your YouTube account with your Google Plus account and then taking ownership. And I ended up doing that as well. So my accounts got merged. There is no solution to this that Google provides.
That we know about it.
Right. Unfortunately, Miles is not here because, of course, he works at Google, so we could pester him about that. But unfortunately, there isn't a way to do this manually. You could, of course, delete one of the accounts and just assume the other account and just use that other account.
And upload all your your videos, you lose your comments,
you lose
your views.
Yeah. What do you think about that idea, Robert, just deleting one of your accounts and accepting it?
So I think that's I was thinking of that, but what if I delete that account, would I be able, my question is how could I merge it? How could I get my photos from that account and then transfer them to my other account?
Okay,
I don't have many photos, really. There's only like 10, but...
Yeah, do it manually if it's 10. The quick answer is do it manually if it's 10. Now, Google has a really great project called Transparency. I can't remember, it's data... you can download all the content that Google has about you and download it as a zip file anytime you want. You can go into your account, log in, and download it all. It's a massive collection of stuff. And that's one way to get your data out. And then you'd have to import it back in. If you have two Gmail accounts, and that's one of the problems, you can actually use a mail client on your computer to connect to both and then move them over. I've done that manually before. You use IMAP connecting to both your accounts, and you can shift the email from one to the other. It takes a while, and Google will terminate your connection after like 3 hours of doing this, and then you have to do it again a few hours later. But it's pretty quick to do this. And that basically just allows you just drag and drop them over. And the photos, if you've got 10 of them, I think your answer is clear. Just download them and upload them again. Keep in mind that you can keep – so I have 3 Google Plus accounts. I don't want 3 Google Plus accounts, but I have one for myself. I'm plus Lyle Troxell on Google Plus if you want to follow me. I'm also have got a GeekSpeak one, which I do not use, and I also have a one for work, a Netflix one, which I do not use. And on both those other accounts, what I have there is my real profiles over here. I don't post over there, I don't add to people over there, and I remove those accounts from being searched so that people don't find them. Those accounts potentially can have photos and stuff, but I never add to them. So that's kind of the way I do it. I kind of keep all the accounts, but try to point all traffic to one location. And that's what you could do if you want to keep your YouTube account, because that's easier. You don't have to delete them and stuff. The one that had the YouTube videos and the Gmail videos, you could just, the Gmail you could move over, and then you could just set up a forward for your old email account and move it over. We're running out of time, though. I've got to say goodbye. Good luck on your dilemma, Robert.
You.
Let us know how it goes. Thank you.
I sure will. Thank you. You guys are awesome.
Thanks.
Thanks.
This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me has been Mr. Ben Jaffe. Next week, we have geek guest Sharad Manjulik on from Adobe. He's chatting with us about Lightroom Mobile on iOS and also about digital photography workflow. I'm looking forward to having him back on the show.
That's going
to
be fun.
That is.
Yeah.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So reuse any of our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is Public Radio for Central Coast 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and live online at kosp.org. To find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. And of course, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Google+. And of course, give us ratings and reviews up on iTunes. We'd love to have that. So more.